What we had in the past was the standard air, sea, land, ground, and space writ large as domains, and they're distinct in the geographic locations. But with the advent of information technologies and computers and virtual communications, now you have something that bridges all those spaces, and it does it, except for the sea to a degree, both from the physical space and then the virtual intellectual cognitive space. And then they thought that there's a need to capture that distinction because there are operations that occur just in that battle space, but more importantly, it has a unique blending with the other four traditional battle spaces. So CyberComm and others have worked hard to define it in a way that adds value but also is integratable, because you don't want to, it's not like you just have a fight at sea only or in the air only. It's how you integrate it with the ground component and the ground domain. Same thing with cyberspace. It's both a distinct piece and something that has to be integrated. So as of today, through the Joint Staff and Secretary of Defense's office, they define cyberspace as an operational domain and something different from the other domains that you need to train, organize, and equip for. So that's why they call cyber a fifth domain.
So what would you consider then to be the top cyber threats here and now?
There's two. The top threat for us, those in uniform and, in the government and in places that are critical to us in the commercial realm, is the insider threat. It's the folks who, through malicious intent or ignorance, do things that make the systems more vulnerable. And we've had that issue, it's been a problem on a front burner since about 2008, where whether it's, somebody with, takes a thumb drive from one system to another system and infects the systems or allows enemies to get access to systems they could never get to, from, classified to unclassified, from unclassified to classified, or private manning, that's somebody who did a lot of damage to the United States in terms of sensitive information and reputational issues, et cetera, and he was the guy on the inside. From the outside, I think the greatest threat is the growing competition, because this is a very interactive domain, very much dependent on technology and the use of technology as it advances. Because technology is proliferating and the use of systems and weapon systems is proliferating down to the lowest levels, it's something that doesn't take huge industrial base support to leverage threats and weapons in cyberspace, if that makes sense. So you have nations and non-nation entities out there that can actually do damage to us and can hurt us through cyberspace, and that's probably the greatest threat in that the threats that come to us can come from very many places, and it's not going to be something we necessarily recognize, as a standard nation threat to us, like historically the Chinese or the Russians have been, as an example. It may not take that form because it can come through other avenues to get to us. So that's where we tend to be. We think that's the vulnerabilities we face from the inside and then from the outside.
A lot of threats are common to every agency or company or entity that actually might have some sort of presence in cyberspace. Would these then be unique challenges for the military?
Yes, unique in the sense that we are critically dependent on cyber capabilities for how we provide intelligence, command and control, maneuver, logistics. There's a critical interdependency between cyberspace and our operations. But what's really unique is we have to operate in life and death situations, and we cannot afford to be encumbered and unable to have some predictability, some mission assurance in how we're going to do things. So that makes us different, I think, in terms of how we have to respect and use cyber operations.
Is there anything specific that can be done to protect cybersecurity within the supply chain? I know that's been a unique challenge, particularly for the military over the past couple of years.
Well, there is, in terms of like PKI considerations and standard TTP tactics, techniques and procedures. But really, the DIA has a lead there, and other organizations, and we can do our best to support evolutions along this way, and we can be more protective. We are doing things to help us. As an example, We have a lot of critical infrastructure, and over the last couple of years, we've looked back and said, you know, one of the things that we've neglected and not looked at hard enough was this, the cyber piece of it. You know, how we connect with and how we protect and how we provide power to the systems that we depend on. And so we have teams right now that are going throughout the Marine Corps to look at our total critical infrastructure requirements, and then we have people assigned to those teams who are looking at the cyber specific aspects of it. So in that regard, we're looking at cybersecurity, but in terms of supply chain management, we're more of a user than somebody who provides a frontline function.
We're talking with Colonel Stephen Zadi, the Chief of Staff for Marine Forces Cyber Command. The cyber workforce itself, everybody, it seems, whether you're private sector, military, public sector, academia, everybody is looking to fill that cyber workforce need. So what would your requirements be over the next few years?
Well, the service-specific requirements is really the competition you just described. We in the military, because, like I said earlier, are critically dependent on, you know, full-spectrum cyber operations to operate in all the domains across the battlefield functions. We need these special talents to function at all levels, from, you know, junior through very senior officer enlisted folks. And we want to recruit and retain these folks. And because of the demands of the 21st century, other people want them too. So we have to figure out a way to recruit, to train, and retain these folks in a way that they'll stay for that 20, 25-year career so that we can be the most capable force on the battlefield or in, you know, crisis operations. So we have some unique requirements because, you know, going to ask somebody who's got a high-demand skill set to sacrifice a lot to serve their country and obviously usually monetarily get a lot less pay relative to the civilian market. And we're going to ask them to do that in you know, face the sacrifice of, you know, being away from home on a number of occasions and deploying overseas and being away from your family and all these kinds of things. So we have some unique demands on top of just, you know, competitive nature of the job market itself. But, you know, we are looking right now at identifying what military occupational specialties are most applicable to the cyber workforce and then how we might treat them differently than other job fields in the Marine Corps.
So anyone who might want to fill that slot would have to be uniform personnel? It wouldn't be a civilian?
I think it's going to be both. I think looking toward the future, it will be both, because there will be some requirements that necessitate somebody going forward into a crisis or combat environment, and we probably don't want to do, as a Marine Corps, that's not our model to do that with a large civilian governmental workforce. But there, because of the domain is virtual, you can do a lot of things from a lot of different places, and you don't have to necessarily be in a, you know, crisis or conflict environment to perform the function. Some of those things can be done with a general service folks, GS government, federal employees, or even with contractual support based on the specific requirements that you have at the time. So I think as we move forward, we'll have a mix of highly trained uniformed personnel who can do these things both in the tactical organizations that we deploy and from home station, and also a mix of folks who are general federal employees and even contractual support.
And I wanted to follow up with the question about STEM. Do you see this, the pool as being shallow, and that more STEM needs to be taught in schools even as early as junior high or high school?
Well, I would say the answer is kind of both, and let me try to articulate why. I do think that we need more science and engineering and math to understand this, because it's very technologically oriented, and how it works together and how it fits together and how you do the work in this field is critically, it's critically important that you understand that aspect of it. So I think education is important, and then in the STEM areas, it's critically important. So the more that we can enhance that education for our workforce, both in terms of those who come here to do this type of stuff and those who have to leverage the technology in the future, that's critically important, because the world's not getting less complicated. It's getting more complicated. The second issue, though, is the folks that do this, it's an art. There's an art aspect of this where, you know, you can take somebody who in junior high and high school really like to play around on computers and has an innate ability to navigate and find things, kind of the hacktivist kind of piece. And I'm not saying it's all, you know, not all the bad stuff, but just they really enjoy that aspect. That's a certain skill set or an inclination that somebody has that really can't be taught. So what you need in this workforce is those who have the education, but you also need the people that have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit. They can use and take advantage of technology, if you will, and that's not necessarily something that can be taught in a classroom.